Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, in this episode, I got the chance to speak to Neil, aka the Adventurous Investor on YouTube. Neil is actually a returning guest to the show, and one of the reasons that he's making a second appearance is that he's one of our 12-person strong team that we've put together in order to raise money for the Movember Foundation during the month of November. So if you're not familiar already, basically, the Movember Foundation raises money for men's mental health and suicide prevention. In order to participate, you effectively have a shave on the 1st of November and try to grow the most glorious mustache you possibly can throughout the month. So that should be fun. We've got, like I say, a group of 12 of us together, and we're planning to do weekly live streams as part of that on my YouTube channel. So that's the Investing with Tom YouTube channel if you want to go ahead and check that out. And while we're on the topic of YouTube, if you're not familiar already, this podcast actually now has a video version as well. So just jump over to YouTube and look up the Investing with Tom podcast, and you'll be able to track that down if you want to follow along with video versions of these episodes. Now, Neil got his start in investing predominantly through real estate, but over the past few years, he has started to transition more towards investing in equity markets and stocks. So as part of that discussion in this episode, we covered a few of the companies that both of us are quite familiar with. So more specifically, the A2 Milk Company, a little bit on Alibaba, and also a bit on Micron, which is a business that is pretty new to both of us, but is one we also find quite interesting. But for the real estate fans out there, we did definitely get into some real estate discussions as well. So we covered it a little bit on the first time Neil appeared on this podcast, but he's recently made a couple of investments into Japanese real estate. So really interesting to kind of cover off that topic with Neil. Now, before I roll the episode, one apology from myself. We were battling some really laggy internet as we recorded this episode. So the audio quality should hopefully be okay, but there was sort of a 2-second lag between myself and Neil as we were recording the episode. So apologies in advance for the couple of kind of awkward pauses and cutting each other off that are present, particularly in the first half of the recording. But it was a really enjoyable conversation with Neil nonetheless. So if you want to check out any of what Neil and I are doing with the Movember campaign, links will be in the show notes for that if you want to check it out. And I'll also leave a few links to Neil's various social media platforms as well. So without further ado, let's roll the episode, and I hope you enjoy. Neil, the Adventurous Investor, thanks for coming on the podcast. I'm glad to have you back. How's it going?
Awesome, bro. No, it's good to be back. It's always good yarning with you, mate.
Yeah, for sure. We've teamed up for this podcast, but we're also pretty cleanly shaven at the moment because we're both doing the Movember campaign. have you figured out what style moustache you're going to try put together just yet?
Nah. I was having a little bit of a look actually yesterday, and I was like, what should I go? I mean, I've done Movember in the past, and I went with the trucker or whatever it was. And
oh, yeah.
Jesus, by the end of the month, I was looking pretty rough. So I don't know. I might just go with the standard, eh? I don't know. I was thinking about putting out for a bit of a poll, but then I'm sure everyone will just go with the most outrageous one if I put it out to a poll. So I don't know. Don't know what to do.
Yeah,
how about yourself?
Yeah.
Any ideas?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a bad decision to get crowd votes on that sort of thing because it's going to look terrible. Oh, no. I feel like with with wives and girlfriends and stuff, I feel like even just participating in Movember is tough to get across the line. So you don't want to be going for outrageous handlebars and truckers and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, I think we might just have to keep it with the classic Mo, but it'll be interesting. We've got a good team together.
What's that?
It'll be interesting. We got a good team together, 12 of us this year.
Oh, it's so good, mate. Now, thanks heaps for putting it together. I think it's awesome, mate. It's such a good charity, and they're doing a lot of good. Like, it's incredible how far they've grown from, I think it was 2003 they started, maybe, I think it was. But it was just like started with 30 blokes, and now I think They're up to maybe 6 million or something, people growing mm-hmm. those, which is just phenomenal, eh?
Yeah, it's crazy impressive. I think it's
awesome.
Yeah, I think the total amount raised is probably around $1 billion now, I want to say, or it may even be greater than that at this point since 2003 or something when they started out, a couple of Aussies over a beer. Yeah,
right. Shit, I didn't realize it was that high. That's awesome. Yeah. No, I was reading about their history just only a few days ago, actually, having a bit of a look through the website. And I was reading about just a couple of lads having a laugh. Thought, should we grow a mo? Yeah, let's do it and go with that. Razzled up 30 mates and away they went.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a cool story. Well, I'm hoping we can pull something together. If anyone's listening in and doesn't know what we're talking about, Neil and I are two of a 12-person finance YouTuber team, which we've called, what is it, the Margin of Shavedy, which shout out to all the Ben Graham fans listening in. You'll know what that means. great name. We've got to thank Karan Ganani for that one. So, yeah, hopefully raise some good money for a good cause. I'm just doing the Mo, but I know, Neil, you've been doing the Mo and you've run like two back-to-back 10Ks, which I'm not going to be doing that part, but that's pretty impressive as well.
Yeah, legs are hurting now though.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well maybe for some of those for some of the people that maybe didn't listen to the first time you're on the podcast or haven't come across you before, do you want to just maybe quickly introduce yourself and kind of how you got started in this whole investing and finance world and with the YouTube channel as well?
Yeah, for sure. I've always had a pretty sort of keen interest in business and investing, I guess, from quite a young age, even as a teenager, selling odds and ends and things down at the local markets and whatnot. And I think just as you progress through life, you always sort of, I don't know, similar to yourself and similar to probably a lot of investors out there, I'd imagine, you think it's pretty easy to work out that you just work, your Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and you don't do much with that money, you're not going to have a very comfortable retirement, let's say. It's just a no-brainer, I feel. So that's sort of what got me started. And then you just start reading a few books, like the classic Rich Dad, Poor Dad was one of the first books I picked up, actually, which was awesome. It's such a good sort of basic sort of foundational book to sort of open your eyes a little bit to the world of investing, I guess. Over the years, I've predominantly focused on property for a good number of years, actually. That was my sort of main core focus, whereas only recently, probably over the last, I've been investing in the equity markets for a long time as well, but early days I didn't really know what I was doing, as most probably people probably fit into that boat a little bit as well. Starting the YouTube channel once you sort of got forced into lockdown. And to be honest, I hadn't really looked at YouTube at all with regards to investing. I just didn't think there was anything on there. I was mainly looked up for the odd snowboarding videos, and then come across yourself and Brandon and Hamish and a few other YouTubers on there and thought, bugger it, I might have a crack myself. It went from there.
Yeah, nice. Well, I'm glad you did because it's going well, and it's like one of the reasons that I always talk about starting a YouTube channel is to like meet other like-minded people, which I don't know about yourself, but I find that really challenging in everyday life to talk to people that are interested in finance and investing, and especially once you get really niche, like you go from just investing in general to investing in shares to value investing like Warren Buffett style. It's like obviously fewer and fewer people are into that, so I'm glad you joined the YouTube community as well.
Oh, it's so good, mate. Like you say, it gives you access to like-minded people. It's so good. Like, I wouldn't know you if I didn't, obviously if I could watch you consume your content, but it's awesome. My wife stirs me up a little bit, like, hanging out with your YouTube friends sort of thing, but I tell her to shush. I don't know. I really enjoy it, just that aspect of it. It's probably one of the main sort of things that keeps me sort of ticking away with it. It also just forces you to keep reading, keep learning, keep researching about investments, and then you just get better and better as you progress along with it, I guess. I initially started out investing in the equity markets, or especially over these last sort of like 5-6 years, off the back of a lot of Scott Pape's recommendations. Are you familiar with Scott Pape, the Barefoot Investor?
Yeah, I haven't read a lot of his stuff, but I'm certainly familiar with who he is.
Yeah, awesome guy. So he had a blueprint. He called it the blueprint subscription, sort of a bit like the Motley Fool, but actually better. He's had all his books, which covered a lot of basic sort of stuff, which his books are fantastic if you're just starting out on your investing journey. But the blueprint was more of a sort of advanced sort of level from that. And within each month, he put out like a newsletter mainly focusing on ASX listed companies. But he did actually have Berkshire Hathaway in there. But he recommended that back when it was trading at around $80 from memory. So he comes from that same sort of value-based investing sort of mindset as well. And he partnered up with another guy by the name of Mike Kemp, who's actually written a couple of fantastic books as well. One's called Uncommon Sense. I can't remember what the other one is. But, they actually cancelled that subscription last year, June last year, which then in turn forced me to start doing a lot more of my own research to start reading and learning a lot more about companies myself rather than sort of relying more on their recommendations. So that was sort of...
Yeah. Yeah,
and
nice.
They give you good write-ups on the businesses.
Yeah, sorry, we're battling that couple of second lag here.
it's brutal. Been, your video is just hasn't moved for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, this is going to be painful for anyone watching, but I'm sure we'll just have to, anytime I talk, I'll just talk for a few minutes, then you can talk for a few minutes and we won't have the little back and forth. Then we'll be all right. All right, anyhow. One of the things I am keen to touch on is, I guess getting into more individual companies and that sort of thing. We seem to have a little bit of overlap with kind of some of the companies we've been digging into. I know you've put together some good videos on A2 Milk specifically, and also Alibaba has been like everyone's been talking about Alibaba, but that's been a really interesting one to follow as well. So how are you finding kind of getting into more individual company research?
Oh, I'm loving it, eh? It's awesome. No, I really do enjoy it, but especially obviously I'm pretty new to the cloning, the 13Fs and all that. So, well, not full clone, but I'm only sort of new to that probably over the last year and a half, I guess, since the lockdown started, I guess, is this where I started after watching a fair bit of your content and you were talking about the 13Fs. That's when I was like, I didn't even realize about the 13Fs. And I was like, man, that's a pretty good
that's
resource.
Like a cheat code, yeah.
I watched actually I think you even called that video cheat codes or hacks or something like that. And I was like, man, this is awesome. I didn't even know this was a thing. So I was pretty stoked to get onto that. And now I follow it religiously like yourself and a lot of other, sort of value-based YouTubers as well, because it's such a good space to be digging and learning and trying to research and trying to dig a bit deeper into, what they're seeing in these companies. It's such a great, great, great resource actually. Yeah. Or even like I think it was – I don't know if Brad put up a video recently about Monash Pabrai's returns over the last year, and he put a little clip where Monash Pabrai was talking about just setting up a cloning fund, and he was at a university doing a lecture and he was just – it was a bit of a yarn with one of the young lads. He said, yep, go set up this fund, just cloning fund, just go with it. You'll outperform sort of thing, which was – have you seen that clip I'm talking about?
That does ring a few bells, yeah.
It's quite a funny little clip, eh? I haven't actually seen the full length video, but he's like, David, go set this fund up. You'll outperform. but it was quite interesting. But yeah, definitely. I suppose with researching the companies, I was always sort of pretty focused on the ASX and the NZX because you're obviously a bit more comfortable here because we know it a bit better. But like only over the last sort of year and a half, 2 years, I suppose I've got a bit more comfortable with investing overseas, which just opens you up to so much more opportunity, especially, when you start now we're looking into China and Japan and the US and everything. It's awesome. There's no sort of boundaries there with how far you can, like Brad and Jason from the After Dinner, they're getting into Rhesus, which is that's an interesting little company there as well.
It's crazy some of the places investing sort of takes you. Like you start out just thinking, I want to put a few dollars to work because I read Robert Kiyosaki saying that I'm going to be going backwards if I don't. And then, next minute you're studying these little like Turkish real estate companies that some US investor who has pretty good returns is talking about. That's a funny old world how that happens.
Yeah. Oh, it's awesome though. It's awesome where it takes you. And then, yeah, to some of the investors that you sort of start to learn from and just sort of really use as your North Star, I guess. Well, for me, myself, of yeah, I don't know. It's the, you know, you sort of – I never used to have a main sort of strategy or what's the sort of – no sort of framework to go off when it comes to investing in the equity markets. Sort of everything was a bit open and I'd just sort of go with what I thought was a good buy at the time sort of thing, all off the back of a lot of Scott Pape's recommendations, which was quite well. It worked out quite well. Most of his companies he recommended did pretty well. He was outperforming. I think from memory he was around 16-17%. Compounded every year. And he only had that fund, the Blueprint fund open, I think from him, maybe 5 or 6 years. And then he shut it down the end of last year. But he was beating the market. They were backing that on the ASX, I think, using that as the benchmark from memory.
Yeah, interesting. And so how do you think about sort of balancing the real estate portfolio, which, as I understand it, is sort of still the bulk of your investing focus with sort of shifting more into the equity markets? Do you feel like that's where you'll kind of tend to move towards over time, or are you still imagining that you'll sort of want to build the real estate portfolio as well?
I definitely feel like I am transitioning more to the equity markets now. But it's awesome to have the property portfolio there as well. And especially sort of across a couple of different countries as well, sort of minimizes the risk there a little bit. And I still definitely am very pro investing in property as well, but yeah, there's definitely a few transactional costs along the way and it's a lot harder to get in and out of property. And I mean, I just sold a property only a few months back, one in Owakuni actually. I think we briefly touched on
it. Yeah.
In our first episode. Yeah. So we did a little subdivision there. I think we even talked about that as well. And we just sold off the back property there, which was nice. It freed up a lot of capital now to I'm struggling to find places to allocate it, but it definitely freed up a bit of capital. And it paid down. We paid off one of our lodges in Japan as well, so that was nice to have both those now freehold. And then, yeah, it gave me a bit of extra capital to, use to invest into the equity markets now. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I'm struggling to find places to put it a little bit. I don't want to be too heavily weighted in Alibaba.
I was about to say, have you just put all that money into Alibaba and it's now down 30% or something already?
I have definitely taken a couple of bites of the old Apple, the Bubba Pie, and I do have a few put contracts on it as well, but none of them have come through. They just keep expiring without getting put to me. But yeah, I've still got one at the moment actually. But yeah, so that's basically that. But yeah, A2, good old A2 Milk. That was one of the first companies that I, you know, I just finished reading Rule One, and then I was like, oh, fired up. And I think I was working through Investors as well at the same time. And I was also studying at uni, and I was doing a little accounting unit through UTAS here in Tasmania. They put out a free unit you could study for. Everything was paid for. It was a bit of a stimulus pro for COVID, basically. A postgrad cert in business. So we jumped on that, which was full on for 4 months. But yeah, I was doing an accounting unit with that, so I was starting to learn the ropes a little bit when it comes to accounting, understand what I'm actually looking at. And then, yeah, I got all excited with A2 as it started dropping back more and more, as a lot of investors did. I thought, yeah, jumped in. I think it was around maybe their second or third downgrade of earnings. You know, they downgrade their earnings and then that day they dropped like 12 or 15% or something. But, yeah, so I'm still currently down on my A2 position by around 30%. It's the worst performing stock in my portfolio at the moment.
Yeah, well, I'm in the same boat there. A2's it's the smallest position I have. It's not a very meaningful amount of money, but I think I'm down around 15% maybe. So I sort of averaged into that. I think I had about half of the purchase at maybe $10 a share and the other half about six or somewhere in the $6 range. So
nice.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Like it's, I mean, it was the biggest company in New Zealand for a while there by market cap, which is kind of crazy to think about compared to the Fisher & Paykel Healthcare and Fonterra's of the world and so on, especially for like the volume they were doing relative to something like Fonterra. But they'd just been growing so fast for such a long time, and it was like the most pristine set of financials you've almost ever seen, like no debt, compounding at 20-something% a year, and now they've stumbled. So it'll be interesting to see how they come out the other side.
It's like you say, the numbers are off the charts. You're like, this is, and you know, especially just coming off the back of reading Rule 1, I was like, oh geez, this is seems like a bit of a no-brainer. But yeah, it was good though. It was good to – it was probably quite good actually that it didn't just, you know, like ping back up within a week or two and then I was like, geez, yeah, I've cracked that. It's a good sort of reminder that, you know, there's a fair bit of skill involved with it all.
Yeah.
But no, it's definitely – I enjoy, you know, reading along with how it's all going. And I'm still fairly confident in it. But, yeah, we'll just have to wait and see, I guess.
Yeah, so how are you sort of thinking about A2 at the moment in terms of what's going on with their business and plans for that position sort of moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be adding to it. I think at the moment I'm currently around 6 or 7% of the portfolio is in A2. So I'm pretty happy with that allocation to it, to be honest. But I don't know, they're sitting on a fair bit of cash. They've got, I think, oh, they've got about 850, but if you back out the Matura Valley Milk, I think they're only sitting on around 600 on in cash. So the balance sheet is solid, eh? Like that's phenomenal. And it's just they just need to get that the redistribution back into China back on track, which they seem to be really struggling with. You know, you read a few reports about that, and I don't know, that seems to be the real downfall with them. And like they've almost written off the Daigou network in China, it seems. Whereas, you know, Bubs just came out the other day and they've seemed to be back online over there. I mean, they're a lot smaller company, but they've seemed to manage to navigate it a bit better, I feel. But I don't know. It's an interesting one to follow along with. But I don't know. I mean, they're pushing out into America. They're at pretty early stages in America as well, which is, you know, there's a fair bit of room for growth there, I guess. And I think having that Matura Valley Milk acquisition was a pretty good move, I feel anyway, you know, not being so more reliant on Synlait for product. And as they grow, they obviously need more product. So they've still got Synlait there to, you know, buy their product as well. But I don't know. What's your sort of take on it? Where do you sort of see it sort of heading? I think, I don't know. I hope once borders open back up. Sorry, you go.
I've got a pretty similar take. So, I mean, I was sort of running through some of the numbers with it initially and I was like, man, you have to be – you have to be pretty pessimistic for this not to be at least modestly undervalued. And if you're a little bit optimistic, it started to look kind of really cheap at certain growth rates and, you know, cash flow projections and so on.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
That's kind of where I got to with it initially. It is quite uncertain, I guess, at least in the short to medium term, kind of what the, you know, what the next maybe year or two looks like for A2. As you say, like the Daigou channel has had a lot of disruption, and it was actually interesting kind of learning about the Daigou channel with Alibaba's Taobao business as well. I can maybe tell you a story about that in a sec. But that's a really difficult channel to run during a pandemic, it turns out. And then you've got this sort of overarching theme of like declining birth rates in China is kind of a point that sort of keeps coming up as well. But then on the other hand, you've got, you know, this recent crackdown on like the Chinese for-profit education sector, which as far as I can tell, seemed to be a massive deterrent from people having more kids because it was so expensive to like educate your kids once they got to a certain age. And like, yeah, these stories of kids at young ages doing like crazy, crazy hours of schooling. And I don't know. So I think I almost feel like you're with the distribution side of the business and with sort of the birth rates in China driving obviously demand for A2 infant formula and so on. I feel like you've got to be getting very close, if not past, like the worst possible times for both of those things. So, you know, if A2 can still get through that time with no debt, and I think they still produced like $80 million in cash flow or in earnings even after their massive inventory write-downs and stuff. Like it's not the type of business where there's a large risk of it going to zero, at least as I look at it. Like it's hard to go back. I think it was Peter Lynch who said it's hard to go bankrupt if you got no debt. So that's kind of where A2 is currently sitting. It's just, you know, the big question is sort of what kind of growth rates can they return to once we get 2 or 3 or 5 years kind of down the track?
Yeah, that's it exactly. I mean, like you said earlier, if you slap a bloody, you know, these previous growth rates on it, it looks incredibly cheap. But, you know, you've got to rein that in a fair bit. It's definitely, it's still an interesting company. I'm definitely not wanting to sell, that's for sure. But, yeah, you've definitely got to look out over the next sort of 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and then it looks a lot better. And like I have, sorry, you go.
No, you go.
I've been doing just a bit of market research with my young fella Finn there, because we're complimenting him a little bit with some infant formula as well. And it is 100% noticeable how much more he likes A2. Like it's night and day, eh? Like I don't want to be, you know, coming out saying that the other ones are rubbish, but it is quite remarkable how much more he likes that compared to the other products out there available on the market here in Australia. I mean, you're paying a lot more for it. I actually got one on special, which I thought maybe this is part of that write down of the some of the stock, the 90 mil or the 100 mil, whatever they're writing down. So that's what got me started. I was like, oh, it's on special. I've got to try it now. And then from there, we're hooked on it now. Just he likes it a lot more than the other stuff. The other stuff, you know, he'd be sort of like you're trying to feed him dirt or something. Whereas this one, he's straight onto it, and he knocks the whole bottle over pretty comfortably.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. Keep him on. Keep him on. Don't wean him too young, Neil.
No, definitely not. You're eating this till you're 16 years old. We've just started feeding him, actually. Like solids. Well, it's not solids. It's like this buddy. Rice cereal stuff, but we've been mixing a bit of A2 milk powder into that as well, which he really seems to like. It's a messy job, but he's starting to get the hang of that.
Yeah, good stuff. It's an interesting one, eh? Like I really can't see myself adding to that position too much unless we get a year or two down the track and it's still kind of beaten up. Maybe I'll think about it as kind of new cash comes in. But this is actually one of the – so I've done like a couple of checklist kind of videos in this last week, and A2 is actually A2 is actually one of the reasons that a particular point is on that checklist, and it was basically along the lines of don't add a new position just for the sake of diversification, or don't add a new position because it looks interesting when there's something even more interesting in your portfolio. And that's kind of where I'm at with A2. Like, I think if things work well, maybe it's a double, maybe a 3x over a slightly longer period of time if it returns to those previous growth rates. But I'm kind of at a point now where I think there's more interesting opportunities where there is a little bit more clarity around what the future looks like as well. I'm not sure how you think about that.
100%. No, definitely very similar thoughts there. But like you said earlier, I think that definitely the worst of it's been behind us now. Like early days pandemic there, you know, it was a bit undecided. It was, but I think, like you said, I think the worst of it now, like Australia's pretty much starting to open up over here now. Vaccine rates are pretty high here. And I think I'm not quite up to speed with what's going on in New Zealand with the vaccine rates there, but you know, everything seems to start to be opening up again, which obviously would improve their distribution over there. But we'll just have to wait and see, I guess.
Yeah, time will tell, as it always does.
Yeah, wait and see. Straight from the Investors Podcast, the Young Investors Podcast.
Young Investors Podcast, I like it. Yep.
That's their catch line.
Catchphrase, yeah. We need to come up with a catchphrase for this podcast, I reckon.
They have to put some thought into it.
If anyone's got a catchphrase for us, drop that in the comments below, and I'll try and sneak that in. Maybe I'll take 3 or 4 different catchphrases and just weave them into a few episodes and see if anyone
picks up on it. Yeah, definitely.
That could be an idea. Yeah, what was I going to say before? Oh, around the Daigo channel. So when I was first looking into Alibaba, I have a friend who lived and worked in China for a little while and did market research on different e-commerce platforms in China for a New Zealand company who was looking to export products there. And one of the really like just things that blew my mind about the whole Daigo channel, which if anyone doesn't know, it's basically like a reseller. So someone goes to Australia, for example, and buys a whole bunch of A2 milk product and then sends that back to China and they make a little business kind of out of that, which is great for A2 because it means that they don't have to build up that kind of final part of the supply chain, I guess, but it's shown that it does make them a little bit fragile in some places. Or in some situations, I guess. Sure. So it was really interesting. She was actually telling me about Daigo resellers based in China, and I forget where they were flying to, but they'd basically every single week fly out. There's certain products that there's a lot of tariffs on like getting those products into China. And this example specifically was with a lot of like well-known makeup brands that people were buying on Taobao. So these people would fly overseas for like a day trip or a weekend trip, literally like fill suitcases with makeup from these places. And then effectively they'd get to the airport and she just said it was crazy. Like people were taking makeup out of the boxes and throwing out the boxes to make more space in their suitcase so they could fit more makeup like in their suitcase and in their carry-on luggage and shove it in overheads and stuff, all to take back to China to like run their e-commerce business on Taobao.
To resell.
Yeah, it's right. Nuts. Jesus. And presumably similar things are happening crazy. With A2. Yeah.
That's crazy. I think the Treasury Wine Estates got stuck with their tariffs on their red wine at one point. Maybe it was late last year, early this year. They same thing, all of a sudden China said tariffs have gone up through the roof, which just crushed them, eh? I understand about those high tariffs that they seem to just bring in willy-nilly.
Yeah, that's also an interesting aspect of A2 that, I guess if you've got the Daigo channel, it doesn't really matter, but if you're trying to import product or send product to China directly, that could definitely be a challenge. Especially when you're quite reliant, this isn't just A2. This is basically all of New Zealand's agricultural sector is quite reliant on China. So if we have big tariffs slapped on, you know, milk or meat or whatever, that could cripple an industry for sure.
Oh, absolutely. But they've partnered up with the China, husbandry with the 25% owner in the Matura Valley Milk as well. So A2 owns 75%. And then I think, one of their partners over there owns the 25%. So that's nice. They've sort of got a fairly, you know, good relationship there, you'd see. But I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like they say, they can slap tariffs on things willy-nilly if they feel like they want to.
Yeah, it's challenging. You haven't had your young fella try out any of the newer A2 brands that are starting to emerge at all?
No, we... he's just about to jump up because he's 5 months now. And then when it hits 6 months, then we put him on to the next level. Because in those first 6 months, you've got to keep him on the weak stuff, I guess. Don't give him full cream or whatever it is. I don't know. and that's another reason why we didn't actually get the A2 stuff, because the little supermarket here where we live didn't actually stock the one that's for 0 to 6. So they only stocked the 6 to 12. But no, we haven't tried. What other stuff have they got on offer? Like other milk products, is it? Or is it more like food-based stuff?
Yeah, well, there's there seems to be like one of the other kind of beer cases with A2 is that there seems to be other competing brands. Like A2 milk is not something – I mean, A2 obviously has their brand and they have various trademarks and things, but it's not like they have ownership over all cows that produce an A2 protein. Like it's very common in other parts of the world as well. So you've got brands like – and big brands like Nestle, for example, you know, starting to come out with A2 products in various parts of the world. So it'd be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, there was – rumors only a few weeks ago that potentially Nestle might even look to buy the A2 company, which would be kind of interesting as well. But I sort of wonder whether that maybe puts some downward pressure on product pricing over time.
Yeah, they might rein it back in because at the moment it is the most expensive milk on the shelf. Here in Australia, it is for just the little punnet, which is like a month's worth, let's say. And that's not even full time. Like my wife still breastfeeds as well. That's like $38, $39 Australian for that, for a punnet, which is, you know, and then if you compare that to the other brands, they're around half that price, give or take.
Yeah.
So they definitely got the superior pricing on it, that's for sure.
Yeah. That sounds like me buying Gillette razors the other day for Movember. That stings the wallet.
I had to go buy some too. I only got one razor and one head because I haven't been clean shaven for, I couldn't even tell you, maybe 5 years or something. I think since the last time I did Movember maybe. I had to go buy some shaving foam and some and a new razor.
Yeah, well, if hopefully A2 Milk is like our, you know, how like Warren Buffett had his big investment in Gillette, which he called one of the inevitables and worked very well before it got acquired by Procter & Gamble, I think. Hopefully that's us, you know, A2 got that pricing power.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
We'll have to see.
That's it. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. I want to change tack a little bit because I know there's one other topic that we were talking about a little bit before we hit record on this that you're very passionate about. And you said I might have to hold you back because if I ask you a question about it, that might be the full episode. So I've held off for half an hour or so. We spoke about this a little bit in the last episode, but it'd be interesting to get an update and kind of how you're thinking about it. But I know you're super into, well, I guess, travel in general by the sounds of it, but but snowboarding in particular. And last time we talked about you guys buying a place in Japan. Do you want to tell us what you're up to there?
Yeah, for sure, man. Definitely keen on the winters and snowboarding. Like it is definitely an obsession. Definitely. And it's cool. Like prior to the pandemic, we've sort of managed to sort of shape our life around being in the mountains for a part of the year, which is just like a dream come true, you know, like it's so cool. We're only fairly new to it. We only bought the lodge in 2018, the first our little mountain hut, it's called, which is just a small 10 guest rooms, and then we have a couple of staff rooms and then another little Harry Potter cupboard where we hide another staff up there. It was awesome. We had a great season, like coming into the pandemic, actually. That season was our best season yet. Like we were chock-a-block, full booked up to about sort of end of February, early March, and then the pandemic was starting to run a bit. We didn't, to be honest, mate, we were pretty oblivious to the whole pandemic. We were over there just riding every day and had a few guests coming and going, and we had a few people actually leaving Tokyo to get out of Tokyo for because of the pandemic, and they come to stay with the lodge for us for like a month, which was awesome. We had a couple of nice families, really nice Taiwanese family with mum, dad, and the two kids, which was a nice little vibe actually, rather than just having heaps of drunk Aussies running around. So it was a nice way to wrap up the season. And then we left there. It was end of March last year. I think it was March 27th, maybe, from memory. And then, just been back in Tassie pretty much since then. And we've been pretty busy still, though. I mean, the business, obviously, in Japan has pretty much come to a screaming halt. There's no way to pivot, around this, as all our guests are predominantly Australians and Kiwis and, Westerners generally. We maybe, you could say, 2, 3, 5% at the most local, domestic sort of trade. And we actually have to be there to sort of help run it. This last season just gone in Japan, we actually did have a few friends and other previous guests that have stayed with us actually in Japan. So we sort of lent it out to them just to use. It's just to keep the place warm and ticking over. Because the issue is you get a lot of snow there. Like they average around 15 meters a season in Miyako where we are. You need to keep the lodge warm so the roof, all the snow slides off the roof and whatnot, and all the pipes start freezing up. So it's kind of a bit of a win-win to still have people in there, and we're not making any money off it really. But, it just keeps the place sort of ticking over. And then we actually bought another little lodge last year, actually, in the middle of the heart of the pandemic. we were doubling down. It was just too good an opportunity to pass up. We thought tourism's booming at the moment. Let's double down on this, which hasn't done much. We actually haven't even seen it in person. So that was a good move, but it's in a fantastic location. So on Mayoko, we've got four different main sort of commercial ski areas, and then there's a small sort of club field, let's say, on the other far end of the Mayoko Mountain. And this is on the best ski area. Well, in my opinion, it's the best ski area of all four, and it's ski back to the door, ski down to the lift. Like, it's a fantastic location. Wow. So it's a smaller lodge. It's only a seven guest rooms and then like another little staff room. But there's another sweet little log cabin out back, which we're going to use as our sort of living quarters, especially now with Finn, the young bloke, sort of changes things a little bit over there. We'll, don't know if we'll be living at the backpackers. That's quite a lively sort of scene in the evening sometimes. So it'll be nice to sort of retreat from there to a nice little cozy little log cabin. So that's going to be our little quarters, I think, moving forward. Probably won't be much happening this season over there due to, you know, I think Japan still hasn't opened up yet to Australians. We're in the process actually of trying to get our visas, which has been a right headache, like proper pain in the ass. We've been trying to get our business manager's visa. We have a company set up over there, and essentially we're sponsoring ourselves so we can stay there for longer than the 3 months on the tourist visa, but it's quite hard to get that visa over the line. But that's just a very sort of basic overview of what's sort of happening over there. Hopefully next season things have picked back up and we're guns are blazing full steam ahead, because I'm definitely itching to get things, you know, fired back up over there again. And we're sort of expanding, running like a bit of a small sort of ski school as well, myself and my wife and then a few of the other people that we have helping us out at the lodge, the other staff, they're instructors as well, which is awesome. So a lot of our guests, they're sort of beginner to intermediate, so they quite like you know, having that freedom to just, you know, go up for the whole take out for a couple of hours, and we charge it slightly cheaper than the ski schools. So it's a good little in-house little ski school. And we just bought a heap of snowboards as well, actually. We're going to start up a little rental fleet of about 20-odd Never Summer snowboards, which are quite a high-level high-performance sort of snowboard as well, which is, we've partnered up with the Never Summer rep over there, which was a nice little partnership as well.
Yeah, cool. Mate, you've got 100 different things on the go, haven't you?
And then, like I was saying earlier, and then you throw Finn in the mix, which is absolutely amazing. I love being a dad. It's honestly the best job I've ever had. But, man, I thought I was busy before Finn. Finn is just new level of busy. Good busy, though. It's a great busy, eh? Like, he's a good kid. He's you know, he's a pleasure to have around. He's a nice, happy sort of disposition to him. He's a nice, happy little chap. But, yeah. It is nice when he goes to bed at night, though.
I can imagine. Well, we've got him as our – well, I'm just going to include myself in this, but we've got him as our unpaid A2 analyst as well, so that's a nice bonus.
He is. Yeah.
So how'd you go from go ahead.
No, I said he's on the team.
Yeah, for sure. So how'd you go from – how'd you go from sort of traveling, snowboarding to like making the decision to actually buy a place or a couple of lodges over in Japan?
Well, we've managed backpackers in the past, actually in Japan, or sort of sub-managed, let's say. We were sort of looking after the backpacker side of one of the lodges in Niseko, which is in the northern part of Japan, in Hokkaido, the northern island, which was awesome. We were working for an amazing family up there. She was Japanese and her partner was Australian. Had a couple of really, really lovely little girls as well, which are awesome just to hang around. But, we sort of looked after the backpackers and snow cleared, and my wife, and there was four of us in total, you know, keeping up with the day-to-day sort of activities of running a lodge. And their lodge actually came up for sale. They were, they've sold it now, but and I was like, man, I would love to buy this. even because we've done a few seasons there, we get a lot of returning guests. So a lot of the guests sort of know, you know, they sort of get to know you quite well, which is the same thing. It's happening with our lodge where we are as well. We've had a lot of guests that stayed with us in Niseko have come stayed with us in Mayoko as well, which is real nice. It's cool. It's really, really some good people. And you know, everyone sort of just comes together and has that love for the mountains and the snow and everything. It's a good place to be. And I'm really looking forward to, you know, raising Finn over there. Like, it's a little bugger. He doesn't know how good he's got it. Like, snowboarding in Japan in the winters. Like, oh, man. I'm really, really looking forward to that sort of next little chapter there, eh? Having him in the front pack and then just getting him on a little board and stuff. So that's going to be super exciting. But, yeah, anyway, yeah, back to the question. So I went off tangent a bit there. Yeah, I don't know. It's always sort of I did my first season, I think it was 2010, in Gunma, which is in the main island of Japan. And I was talking to a few of the other lads there, actually Kiwi lads that have set up a business over there. They live full-time in Japan now, mainly rafting and canyoning and adventure sort of based stuff like, you know, New Zealand's famous for. And they were saying just how cheap property was. And from there it was sort of planted that seed, eh? And from there it sort of – and then it was only recently over the last, like I said, I think it was June 2018, we bought the first lodge, which was incredibly cheap. But there is still a lot of interest in the area, though. Eh? Like, it's a lot of the lodges actually in Miyoko are owned by Australians and Kiwis and Americans and whatnot as well. There's quite a few that like to buy the property there, especially in Niseko and Hakuba are the main two sort of hotspots in Japan for foreign ownership. And then Miyoko's sort of third on the list, sort of it's the up and coming sort of thing. So property's still quite cheap there. Whereas if you compare it to Hakuba and Niseko, you know, you're paying sort of Queenstown prices, let's say, for property that close to to ski areas, whereas Miyoko's a fraction of that. So it's cool to be at the sort of the bottom level of that. Like, you know, you can sort of, you know, there's still a lot of room for growth and, you know, you can carve a little niche out. And it's a great little town. Like, there's some of the other lodge owners and all that. We've got quite a cool little network of us over there that all work out to, you know, we all help each other out. And because some of the things are quite a headache to sort of navigate your way through. Obviously, with the language barrier and their systems and procedures is quite challenging at times as well. So it's awesome to sort of bounce ideas off other people and how did you do this and who do you use for that and I need to get this guy to certify me for this and all this sort of stuff. So it's awesome that we've kind of got that little group of us over there that sort of all working. Obviously, we're in competition as well, but it's there's plenty of business. When everything's open, it's flat chat, like everyone's booked sort of thing. There's no sort of fighting for business sort of thing or anything like that. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I got a couple of initial questions. Like, I guess if I was going to, I must say I've never had the thought to maybe look at buying a ski lodge in Japan run through my head, but I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. I guess a few like initial questions.
Far away.
Like what does it look like with, I guess, what's the process of like, buying a house or buying a lodge as like a foreigner in Japan, like what's setting up a business and taxes and employees, what's all that sort of stuff look like over in Japan? Is it easy enough to set up or are there language barriers and other headaches and other kind of considerations as well?
Yeah, there's definitely that was the biggest challenge was all of what you've just said. The easy part, actually buying the lodge, piece of cake, no dramas, like that was seamless, really. Like that was the most easiest part of the whole deal, buying the lodge. And saying that they're not just listed on realestock.co.nz or realestock.com.au.
Yeah.
You kind of need to be on the you need to be on the ground and sort of working in, because the locals are very old school. You know, they sort of have their real estate agent they deal with, and they just sort of put faith and trust in him that he's going to sell the property for him, sort of thing. So they don't really list it on any website or anything like that. A lot of it's sort of word of mouth and all that sort of thing. So it was only by sheer luck that we come across the lodge, actually, that first one, which we bought off a Japanese guy. He was the original owner. He built it in 89. It's on a good size section too. It's like 2,100 square. So it's actually on two different titles. But he literally brought this land, built the lodge at the worst possible time. Like, you know, Japan was still at the end of their boom sort of thing. And then he held onto it for like the next 30 years, let's say. And now he's probably selling it at a time when, you know, Miyoko is actually finally starting to pick back up again. It's an old lodge. Like I said, it's 30 years old, but it's Western sort of style as well. It's not very Japanese style, which is awesome. Like all the toilets are Western style and They're not the traditional sort of Japanese sort of squat toilets or anything like that. And it's got a nice big open space and a couple of split levels with the lounge and whatnot. So it's pretty cool. Nice sort of social space at the end of the day to hang out. But, yeah, with regards to, like all the taxes and the company and everything, we've established a company over there as well, which was the best way to go for buying vehicles and forth, and then visas as well. Now we're in the process of trying to get that business manager's visa. You can oversee operations without a visa, but the visa just makes things a lot easier. But, yeah, it's quite a hard job. And now a lot of our friends have actually lost their visa because you only get a one-year visa. And they haven't been able to get back because of the lockdowns and everything. So they've actually they've lost their visa. So they're in the process of trying to get their visa again. That's a real headache, definitely. And it's just the banking as well. Everything, the banking is definitely quite a problem area. They're not up to date with the internet banking. It's nowhere near as good as what we have here in Australia and New Zealand, which makes it quite challenging, especially when you're accepting payments from Australia and New Zealand or wherever it may be. So, yeah, that's definitely challenging. But there's workarounds. You can get around a lot of that. But, what was the other question? There was just basically what's the challenges there? Owning the property. So anyone can own the property freehold. There's no restrictions on ownership. So it's just like buying property in Australia, New Zealand or anything like that, which is awesome. So there's no anything where we have to marry Japanese or be 50% owner with Japanese or anything like that. So,
yeah.
That's a nice feature.
Yeah, cool.
Which
and is it
not many
is
countries
it,
in Asia? Sorry.
Finish that thought, but I'll ask you a question before we get the 2 second lag again. Is it something that you see yourself like scaling up over time? Like, I mean, is it even possible to have like multiple lodges operating, or is it kind of like part business, part something you do for fun, lifestyle kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a good question, mate. That's a solid question. It's definitely scalable. There is another guy, Australian guy, Quinton Nolan. He owns a company called Liquid Snow. He brought a lodge, I'd like to say maybe 8-9-10 years ago, let's say, in Hakuba. Now he owns, I couldn't even tell you, probably half a Hakuba, basically. And he's just ridden that wave up as more popularity of buying lodges. His property's gone up, tripled, quadrupled in value sort of thing over this, but even more so. And he actually owns a couple of properties in Miyoko as well. So he's definitely one guy that has scaled up quite a large business now. And he's probably one of the biggest players in Japan for bringing in Westerners to Japan. And he's also partnered up with another company called Hakuba Real Estate Group, which they tear down old Japanese buildings and develop nice condominiums and Western-style sort of buildings. So he's one example of definitely – and he's done a few podcasts as well, actually, which I've listened to. But, he's definitely – for us, though, I don't know, like – for me, if I was left to go to my devices and wasn't getting rained by my wife sometimes, I probably would start trying to scale things up a bit. But I don't know. It's a fine line. You don't want to get yourself that flat out over there that you can't enjoy it as well. Like, I love snowboarding. That was the main sort of one of the main drivers, so was that I could still snowboard a lot. And I don't like the idea of not doing that and being stressed because we've got half a dozen lodges and there's a lot of moving parts and something breaks or staffing issues. Staffing's quite an issue. We've been lucky. We've had amazing staff, which has been awesome, but a lot of people have dramas with the staffing because they're only there for 2-3 months of the year and a lot of sort of transit sort of crew and, you know, they're good for a month or two and then I don't know. So that's an issue. So ideally we were quite lucky we've had staff that come back year after year. But now with the last couple of years, you know, everyone's sort of moving on with their life, so we may have to start from scratch, unfortunately. But and then we sort of want to get to a point where we're not so involved with it on, like, both me and my wife are pretty flat out throughout the winter every day. You know, we're up changing beds and making breakfast and dropping guests off and just trying to give guests the best possible stay they can have as well, you know, like – we become quite friendly with our guests. Like, when they leave, it's like a mate almost, you know, like so kind of sort of bring that in and encourage the staff to be super friendly and just create that sort of nice atmosphere around the lodge where everyone just sort of catches up at the end of the day and has a yarn and a beer. And Ideally goes to bed at a reasonable hour and doesn't carry on till to the wee hours, because I'm up at 6 a.m. cooking brekkie. But yeah, there's a lot of work involved with running a lodge as well, like just snow clearing and then you've got the, you know, trying to keep on top of your social media as well as a chore in itself. But it's all good fun though. Like it's definitely, it's one of those things that I love doing it. Like it is truly, it's a dream come true. Even if some days it, you know, your snowblower breaks down and there's a storm rolling in and you're under the pump and you've got guests coming in and I don't know, it's all part of it.
Yeah. Still better than sitting in an office, you reckon?
Oh, it's not even comparable. Like you compare it to, I do a bit of FIFO work and oil and gas sort of stuff and I'm just out there like, what am I doing? But yeah, compare it to that and it's so good. Yeah, I love it. And it's a good crew. Like everyone that comes and stays with us is like, everyone's on holiday, everyone's in good mood. Like it's a nice environment to be in and around. I really enjoy it. And then we've partnered up with another local charity called POW, Protect Our Winters. So we end up building like a little terrain park alongside our lodge. Just I'm out there with the snowblower, like shaping up jumps and rails and kickers and things. And then we run like a little rail jam competition on that, and we give away a couple of snowboards. And it's a nice little thing that everyone sort of rallies around in the community. And it's like the first season we had a couple of hundred, and the season 2020 we had maybe 250, 300 people just all get together and throw down some little tricks and things on the jump, and it's a nice fun evening. And now we've partnered the charity up with that as well. It's sort of a nice little way to promote power as well.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
Are you able to speak about your oil and gas work at all and what you're up to there?
Yeah, I'm just a shit kicker out there. I'm bloody utility or roustabout roughneck sort of, you know, the bottom of the barrel sort of stuff, which is still great money. Like it blows me away actually how good the money is considering, you know, especially I've done both. I've done working inside the actual the accommodation part of the rig or the vessel, whatever it may be on, which is easy. You're in the aircon, it's nice. You're making beds, doing laundry, helping out in the kitchen. But then outside, if you're working on the drill floor or running around after the crane, obviously that's quite demanding, especially in the heat. You know, a lot of the rigs are all off WA, off the Western Shelf up there, and then all off north of Darwin, and it's like 40 degrees, 45 degrees, and you're in full covies, steel caps, and it's everyone's like hiding under like bits of steel and stuff to try and get a bit of shade. Like it's just a dirty, grimy, sweaty, can be dangerous if the risks aren't managed well. If you've got a good crew, then it's all good. But yeah, if you've got guys near the end of the hitch, I mean, you're doing 4 weeks out there usually, 4 to 5 weeks, which is a pretty long hitch, 12-hour days. And depending on the rig, it can be pretty noisy, so you're not really getting great night's sleep. It's not like I'm getting a great night's sleep now with Finn either, but it's definitely something we're trying to phase out, actually. It's not something I really want to keep doing, to be honest. And I thought I'd done it, actually. I thought, that's it, I'm done with it. And then COVID. So yeah, that was a bit of a spanner in the works. But it's nice to still have the freedom to go back and pick up the odd swing like I've done. I've actually just got back from this hitch only last week. I was off Darwin for – how's this? So I did 1 week's quarantine before going out to the rig, did 1 week's work on the rig, and then I did 2 weeks quarantine coming back. So it was 1 week's work, 3 weeks quarantine, all paid though. So it was awesome for me. And it was good. I got some time to really drill down on a few things. I did a few courses through Courseria. Have you heard of Courseria?
No.
The online. It's awesome, eh? It's a shout out to Courseria. Just an online education platform, essentially. But you get access to some of the best professors out of the US. I did a financial markets and basic introduction to financial markets where they touch on bonds and a series of different things. But they had Robert Schiller, I think was his name. One of the main sort of presenters in the course. And he's really good to listen to. And it's all nice video form content and, you know, little quizzes and little things along the way and everything. And it was all totally free. I was like, this is phenomenal. Yeah, I punched out like a I think it was a 7 or 8 week course, and like a week and a half, I was just doing that every day. So that was in my little room in quarantine. So that was pretty cool.
It was online nice courses actually. And making YouTube videos in quarantine.
Yeah, I was getting paid to do it. I was like, this is what a pleasure. That was probably the easiest offshore gig I've ever had. I was like, mate, this is easy money. But it's not usually like that.
Yeah, fair enough. So it's something you do for sort of like, do you do sort of like a couple of these 4 week stints a year or?
Exactly. Now with Finn, I miss him so much. That was the hardest part, was being away from, obviously my wife as well, but being away from Finn is tough. Like, it's not a place for raising a family. Like, guys do it and they miss it. Some guys seem to manage it quite well, but a lot of guys struggle with that aspect of it, which is tough. Like, you kind of end up living a split sort of life. You know, you're away there for 1 month and then you're back. But I mean, you're back, usually it's even time, so you're back at home for 1 month as well. But yeah, it's definitely challenging. So I've only done 2 swings this year. I've done this one and then I did one back in February actually. But we'll see. I'm trying to knock it back so I don't have to do it. We do a few other little things where we are here in Tasmania. I'm actually painting a house tomorrow. Me and my wife we've been painting a few houses recently, so that's another little side thing we do as well.
Yeah, and you've got so much going on. I was telling my girlfriend before we caught up to record this podcast, and I was saying, you know, I'm talking to Neil, the adventurous investor, on YouTube, and he's like, she was like, is that the one that has a ski lodge in Japan, or the one in Tasmania, or the one that has the real estate? No, which, and I was like, it's all the same.
Yeah, no, I definitely, it's a bit of a downfall sometimes though, you know, you spread yourself a bit thin. But no, I like being busy, but at the moment it seems like they're definitely very busy. It's good. And like yourself, man, like, you must be flat out with juggling work and the YouTube channel and the podcast and punch card and, you know, and your strongman as well. Like, geez, you must be running a pretty heavy schedule as well.
Yeah, I really wish I was like running the Buffett clear calendar, but I'm definitely not. But I work full time job. It's actually a little easier at the moment keeping up with YouTube because we're in lockdown, so there's not too much else to kind of do on the weekends and that sort of thing. But can get a bit hectic. But I guess I've sort of got the goal in mind, I suppose, of eventually, you know, trying to grow YouTube to the point where it's a full-time gig. So, you know, you've got a little bit of motivation to kind of keep you going. So that definitely helps. Oh. But I enjoy it. Like, it's fun.
It is. It really is fun. I love it as well. I mean, I'm nowhere near at your level or any of these other sort of YouTubers out there. But like we said earlier, just, you know, like, you know, chatting to other guys like yourself, or, you know, there's a few other others that I catch up with on YouTube from time to time as well. Like, it's awesome. Like, I wouldn't know these people without YouTube. So I really enjoy that aspect of it. It's a great part of it. And that'd be awesome, man. If you could go full time, I bet that's awesome.
Yeah. I think it's probably got a double or maybe a couple of doubles away from being a genuine full-time gig, but I guess we're trying to compound it, right? So when I started with one subscriber, we were a double away from two and a double away from four, and now we're only a couple more doubles to go. Yeah. That's the idea.
Yeah, that's it. Man. That's awesome.
It's funny how that plays out, though. Like, it takes so long to get anything kind of starting to snowball, and then it kind of gets a life of its own and gets some momentum after a while. Is that kind of how you found
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Like, most of my videos don't get thousands of views or anything, but I've had a few that are starting to pick up a few views now. It's funny. One of your videos just got recommended only recently, and it was one of your older videos from maybe like two or three years ago, and you had a whiteboard up behind you, and like halfway through the video, you could see the whiteboard was like starting to fall.
It falls off the wall.
Oh, it was awesome content. Like, it was still great. But and then you're like, the whiteboard literally fell off the wall.
I remember that. So I go back and watch some of those older videos, and they're pretty cringeworthy. When I first got into watching sort of finance YouTube myself, I'd been watching like Jeremy from Financial Education, who had the whiteboard videos.
Yeah.
I thought I'd do the same thing. Seemed like a reasonable idea. And, but I bought a whiteboard that was so small and like thin little markers that you can barely read it. And I'm like filming. I think at that time I was filming with the front facing camera on my iPhone and like had it stacked up on some boxes or something. So you got like weird angles. Yeah. I don't know if I even had a microphone. And it's just terrible looking back now. But you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. Yeah, I know. I think I'm sure every YouTuber goes through that. Well, majority would, I'd imagine. I think I did the same. I had my phone stacked up on the ironing board, and it was like the most rugged setup you've ever seen. Yeah, definitely don't go back and watch any of my early videos. They are pretty, pretty rough.
I even go back like 6 months and I'm like, man, I'm talking so fast. Like, settle down, Tom. What are you doing?
Do you think that's a Kiwi problem that we speak too quick? Or are Aussies Kiwis that we do generally speak quite quick?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I just drink too much coffee.
That's what does it, eh?
I don't know. I do find that New Zealanders have like a very, and I'm really guilty of this, have a very like non-committal way of speaking. Like we say, I'm doing it now. Like we say, it's kind of like this, or it's like a little bit, like we don't want to just concisely say something.
Fully say something.
Oh yeah, this is sort of going on. And we kind of like the volume sort of tapers off towards the end of a sentence is kind of like how Kiwis speak, that sort of thing as well. So I've tried to, I guess get a little bit better with the communication style over time, hopefully, but it's hard to iron out 20 years of living in New Zealand or whatever.
It's a shock. Yeah. I get a few people on my videos actually saying, mate, just good, but just slow down. Like, you're flat chat. I'm like, yeah, right. And then the next video, I'm like, I'm like, that's it. I'm going to try and slow it down for this one. And then I've clicked record and I'm away to the races.
Yeah.
That's one of the things, I guess.
Yeah. It's a funny one. Well, I've got one more topic I want to chat to you about because we've covered plenty, but I think in the style of Neil, we should talk about lots of stuff. So the other one
I'm going to cover. Same style as the channel.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It's
I think it's like
you're concentrated in the portfolio and real estate, but there's sort of lots of other stuff that's kind of interesting to talk about, I guess, which is cool. It's like you expand into new areas because if you like turn over lots of rocks, you eventually find something that's actually pretty interesting and like you can, kind of go full hog into that, I reckon. So I think it's good. Yeah. I think it's good. But that last topic, and this is actually one that you brought up, which is one that's kind of been floating around like value investing circles for a few years actually at this point, but it's one I've never really sunk my teeth into is Micron Technology. It's a big holding of Monish Pabrai's, I think. Guy Spier has a small position. I think it's Li Lu's biggest US position. I think he's got a Chinese bank that's bigger, and BYD I think is quite a bit bigger, but it's a big position for him as well. What have you been digging into with Micron recently?
David Tepper has a pretty good position in it. I think maybe the biggest in his portfolio as well. Look, I've only really started looking at it the last sort of week or two. Haven't really gone too deep on it. But, yeah, like you said, it's definitely interesting. And even you just have a high-level look at the fundamentals of it, you're like, phew. And then, obviously, you look at the lineup of people that own it. is also you're like, yeah, right. Like you just rattled off all the names that definitely own it. And a lot of them have been buying, you know, when it was sort of in the 70, 80, 90 sort of dollar range. I've been digging over a few, the most recent sort of 13F to see what people have been doing with it. A few people have been trimming a little bit, but, yeah, that's not sort of neither here nor there really. They're not fully selling out of it from what I could see. Yeah, but it's one of those things, like we were sort of chatting before that we pushed record, was it's definitely right out of my circle of competence, the old the Micron. But what I like to do, I don't know if you do this with either, but I generally find if I buy it, even if it's only a couple of shares or like 3 or 4 or 5, 10, whatever it may be, all of a sudden I start wanting to do a lot more research in it. Like I'd initially find a company, yeah, it looks good, and you spend a, you know, a week or two looking over it or whatever. And then I'll buy like a very small position in it just to sort of start, I don't know, something shifts within my head that I'm like, right, I've got to start digging in a bit more now to see if I want to build this out or sell it. Generally, I don't, though. I don't sell it. I usually become more and more confident with it, which is what I did with Alibaba, actually. Early days, you know, once we learned Charlie was buying it, and I sort of, geez, I've got no idea what's going on over there. But then as you start reading, and I've listened to the Alibaba, the house that Jack Ma built, the book that you recommended, actually, through Audible, which was awesome. And from there, and then watching all the other YouTubers create content around it and reading over it as you do, you become more and more comfortable with investing in China and then investing in Alibaba, and then you start looking at JD.com, and then you start looking at, you know, Pinduoduo, and start, I don't know, it's one of those ones, though, eh? Like, where do you draw the line on the circle of competence? Like, where do you go, nah, it's out of my circle, I'm not touching it, or where do you say, oh, I could probably get my head around this eventually, sort of thing? I don't know, that's something I'm sort of learning at the moment, I guess, trying to expand on the circle a little bit. And as you grow as an investor, I guess that circle becomes bigger. But if you want it to, I mean, you could just niche down and focus. Like you had Hamish on recently, like he seems very focused on just, you know, those basic businesses that he has a really good understanding of, where he's not interested in, you know, Alibaba, which is fine. But yeah, I don't know. How about yourself, man? What's your sort of take on Micron and expanding on the circle of competence, if you will?
Yeah. Well, I first took so I've tried to build this habit of, which is intentional, but I've tried to build this habit of like analyzing a business very quickly. And if I don't think I can get it in my circle or the numbers don't look interesting or whatever, I just discard it. And that's kind of what I initially did with Micron. But having heard Brad talk about it a little bit has helped, like actually laying out what the investment thesis is. I've found with businesses like Alibaba, for example, it seems really complicated on the surface of things. But once you kind of get into the weeds a little bit, you come out the other side of that research, you know, having simplified it down a little bit and kind of getting the main, at least directionally, kind of a good understanding of what's going on. So I wonder if that's really where I need to go next with Micron. Like the thesis seems more straightforward kind of the more I look into it. I don't think I'm ever going to understand the technology of DRAM chips better than the a bunch of other people.
Yeah, but sure.
I think maybe I can get there on kind of the underlying thesis of the business. Like it's an industry that's grown very fast. You know, there's only three big players. Micron's the only one in the West. And, you know, they're buying back shares, kind of trading at a multiple, like they're a commodity business. And the core thesis is they're not really a commodity business anymore because lots of demand and the supply side of the equation's kind of rationalized a lot. So I think it's probably one that warrants more attention, but you do have to be careful. Like we were talking a bit before this with Micron, I think I could get there on all the things we've just discussed or the things I just mentioned, but you know, then I see articles like last week, for example, out of Alibaba saying Alibaba have just developed this chip, but then I've got the Micron bulls telling me that China's 3 years behind the US, and I don't quite know how to get my head around that part of the equation. That's probably the area I would struggle with the most.
Yep. Yeah. Have you looked on Value Investors about it yet? I haven't looked on there to see if they've got any articles on it. I was meaning to dig into that, but haven't had the time to see if there's.
Yeah, there must be some. I was reading a.
Must be heaps.
Yeah, there's a few from various years. The latest one, I think, is April 2020, which discusses kind of a lot of the things that I just mentioned. But the free cash flow that kind of drops out the other side of Micron, I've seen some fairly wide-ranging estimates on that. So that's one that's hard to nail down because it's a business that has been so volatile. It's kind of like where do margins kind of normalize is a bit of a hard one to kind of figure out. So I don't know. I'll do more digging on it.
It seems to me the nature of the industry a little bit, like that cyclicality of it, where it seems to drop back a bit. But if you look at Micron, it generally still, even though the peaks and troughs, it is still generally going up over time, the demand for the chips. But, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, but it's definitely worth definitely reading up on for sure. That's I did actually put some put options on it the other day, but they've already expired. Which would have given me a little position in it if that did get actioned. But, that's as far as I've really got with buying into Micron at this stage. I'd probably like to see it come back probably a little bit more. I'll have to check out some of Brad's videos. I think I've watched one of his where he – because he's made a few on it, on Micron, I think, from memory, of maybe a year ago.
Micron's his biggest position. He had a video that probably within the last month, it's about 20 or 30 minutes long, where he goes through a few write-ups and presentations on Micron. So those would be worth checking out.
Right. I'll definitely have to check that out,
For sure.
I watched, like I mentioned earlier, Justin's on J Money, which is another fantastic YouTuber as well. He did a good little write-up on as well, which I highly recommend. He's done a few videos on it, and he is a shareholder of Micron as well. We're digging into him.
Well, that's one for the watch list. One to just if anyone in the comment section of this podcast episode, or if you're listening on audio form, jump over to YouTube and leave us a comment if you know any good places to go research Micron.
Absolutely.
But Neil, I know you need to run. We've kind of come up on time, so I had better let you go. But I really appreciate you chatting with me. It's always good to get you on the podcast, and I'm hoping to kind of get a few other guys in the Movember team on the podcast this month, so we can hopefully continue kind of pushing that boat and raise some good money for the Movember Foundation. So I appreciate you being guest number one. Unfortunately, that means since you're early in the month, we don't have much of a moustache to show off, but maybe on some of these live streams that'll come through.
When is that first live stream? That live stream's this weekend, isn't it? Saturday, is it?
Yeah, we're going to do so the goal is to do one for every weekend of November. That'll be the idea.
Oh, cool. Nice. Yep. Awesome.
So, like I say, appreciate you chatting with me. If anyone doesn't already follow along with what you're doing, I'll leave actually a couple of links, or I'll leave all your links down in the description on the show notes for the podcast or on YouTube, depending on where you're watching or listening, if you want to go check out more from Neil. And I'll leave also the Movember links down in the description if anyone's keen to contribute to that campaign as well. But is there anything else you want to plug? Neil, anywhere where people can best to go to kind of follow along with what you're doing?
I think you've pretty much covered it. Actually, I did just start a TikTok the other day after I noticed you've gone
same.
I noticed you've gone down the TikTok road, which is not a road I really wanted to go down. But Tom's on there. Better chuck one in. But no, definitely, I think you've pretty much covered it, man. Oh, we're wrong, obviously. I'm not on Instagram for the YouTube channel, but we are for our business for Mountain Hut. I've recently got onto Twitter, but I'm not very active on there. But I've been reading a few of the articles and stuff and following what you and Brad and Frank and everyone else sort of seems to follow on there. And there's some fantastic resources on it, Twitter, eh? So I think that's something I need to spend a bit more time on, to be honest. And giving you access to Monish and, well, not direct access, but,
here. We can try.
It's always interesting to hear. Yeah, you can try.
Yeah, I've got a like once.
Nice. So, yeah, thanks heaps for having me on again, man. It's always such a pleasure yarning with you, bro. It's awesome. Good talking to you, eh?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one of these days, once we're out of the pandemic, I'll have to come to Japan for a snowboarding lesson, and you'll have to come back to New Zealand so we can go fishing, I think is the plan. So,
love to, bro. Absolutely love to. Keen to catch one of these elusive kingies, which I've never been able to land.
Yeah,
well, I think I've had a few on the line, but I've never actually got one on boat, so it doesn't count.
Haven't had a reel with the horsepower to stop one.
We've had a few get onto the lines around the mussel farms around Coromandel, eh? Like when I go fishing with Dad. He's a bit off the mussel farms now. He thinks he's above the mussel farms, but I'm always like, yeah, that's easy money. Let's go where the fish are. But he thinks he's above that now. But anyway, you generally clean up around the mussel farms, especially if you're while they're harvesting, eh? It's easy fishing.
Yeah.
But because there's such a frenzy in the water with the snapper and the karawai running, and there's a couple of kingies sort of circling in there as well. And if you pick one of them up, you bloody know about it. The only issue is when you're in those farms, there's so much, obviously all the mussel farms, all the boys and all the ropes, they wrap you and then they ping the line within bloody 30 seconds flat sort of thing. But it's fun for 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's a little bit like if you're casting lures for kingfish and like in the shallows, like if it's only 5-10 meters deep, or if you're, I've never caught one off the rocks, but if you're like casting lures off the rocks to try catch one, you got to have some good shoes on and just like max drag and hang on before you get reefed. So that looks pretty fun. Yeah. So maybe we'll have to try that one day.
What's the biggest one you've managed to land? Like that one you had a picture was a beauty. That one you put up on YouTube, maybe 6 months back now. That was an absolute ripper.
Yeah, that's the biggest one I've caught. We didn't weigh it. I think it was 1.19 meters or 1.20 meters, which you can put in conversion charts. And I think that comes out 22 kilos or something. I don't know. I sort of thought it might be heavier than that because it looked pretty chunky. But apparently just in the charts, that's what it comes out at. So who knows? Yeah, we'll have to catch
up. Call it 25.
Yeah, just every time you tell the story, you add a couple of kilos. All of a sudden, it's a world record.
I was at least 40. Yeah. That's every fisherman's story seems to be that.
Yeah.
No, I'd love to, man. What's your plan with are you heading up there this Christmas? You must be, eh? Up there for a month off or something?
Yeah, fingers crossed if we're out of lockdown and all that. One of the great things about being in lockdown is you don't take annual leave, so you get a lot built up. And I think I've got a full – I'll be able to take a full month, I think, comfortably probably. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. Yep. Hopefully can have a good summer break.
Awesome. Nice. I can catch a few kingies. Definitely, if I don't end up going back to Japan, I'll probably more than likely be coming back to New Zealand if conditions allow, if Jacinda lets me in without doing quarantine. So I'll be dropping you a line and we'll go catch a fish.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. Thank you very much, Neil. We better wrap it up there, but I'm looking forward to the mo that's coming through for this month for the 12 of us. And, appreciate you coming on. Yeah.
Awesome, mate. Cheers, bro.
All right.
Catch ya.
Cheers.